Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with
Tony Myers, Producer-Director of A Beautiful Planet.
And also on my left,
James Nyhaus. I'm the Director of Photography and Astronaut Training Manager.
Now that's a title.
it's a mouthful.
And it's A Beautiful Planet, debuting April 29th at the National Air and Space Museum here on the National Mall. Great museum, and you guys have all been in there in the IMAX theater, and it's a great place to watch something like this. So I guess start off before we go into anything else, tell our listeners what this sucker is about.
A Beautiful Planet is a film about the Earth, and also about the International Space Station and what you see of the Earth from an astronaut's point of view from the space station.
Wow. How fitting. We just interviewed Buzz Aldrin like 2 days ago. So.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow,
so
that's great.
In keeping with this theme here.
You got a theme going.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So tell me from a camera standpoint, how do you, are you using cameras that are already up on the space station? You know, go into the technical.
This is the first time we've not flown film in space because no space shuttle, we can't fly film. We can't get it back. So we had to go digital. We picked some Canon cameras that we shot with, trained the astronauts to use them before they flew, then flew the cameras up, and that's what they used to shoot. And then when they shot, they would put it on the downlink, and you'd get it down and pull it off the server, and right. Tony could put it on her computer and edit away.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it's nuts.
You said you trained them, the astronauts, to use the cameras?
We trained the astronauts to use the cameras. The buttonology is kind of the easy part for them, technical part. And then the aesthetics, the composition and directing and audio recording, all that's the kind of
basically everything that they need to know to make a movie.
Yeah.
So that includes sound recording and directing their fellow crewmates in scenes and...
Were there any challenges in turning these astronauts, scientists, into filmmakers?
I don't think we've ever had an issue with these guys. They're quick studies. I kind of feel like my brain gets sucked out my ears teaching them sometimes because they want to know so much so fast.
Yeah.
But no, they're quick learners, and they really get into it because they know this is a document of their time on orbit. So it's going to last a while and be in the theaters and... They can show their kids and their grandkids.
Yeah. And were there any other names, Alfonso Cuarón and Emmanuel Lubezki? No,
Chivo had nothing to do with this.
That's hilarious. Okay, so when did they go up? What year? Was it like last year?
They were, the cameras were in orbit for 15 months, okay. And they went up in
September 21st.
Okay. And then, so take me into what it was like when you're getting the footage back. How do you sort of comb through it, and what sort of stuff can we expect to see?
Absolutely fantastic, beyond my wildest expectations. We start with a kind of shopping list of Earth scenes, anyway, and also interior space station scenes that we would like to get, but we encourage the crew to contribute their own ideas to that. And we always say if an alien floats up and puts his face in the window, don't not shoot it because it's on the list.
That wasn't
not on
shot
the list.
Yeah. Don't shoot that.
So the material was absolutely amazing. And the benefit of having 15 months to shoot it in is that you can wait for the weather, which often doesn't cooperate. So we got beautiful scenes of everything that we asked for, and then some that we had never gotten before in 25 years of making films in space because of the nature of the digital capture. We could shoot at night and get stars and city lights and aurora that we could never, ever see before.
So in addition to these beautiful images, what sort of, because I know it's narrated by Jennifer Lawrence, right? And I want to get into how you got her too in a minute, but, what's sort of like the through line? What's sort of your theme to these images?
Well, I wanted originally to make a film that we did this before in 1990. We made a film, an IMAX film called Blue Planet.
Yeah.
And so it was the time to go back 20 years later and see the state of the Earth. But I also wanted to draw the analogy between Earth and the now completed space station because both are closed loop. Systems that require life support, and I wanted particularly young people to sort of get that analogy that even though the space station You have to truck everything up there, you know, water and recycle things and air and food. But it gets periodic resupply ships, but Earth doesn't get any resupply ships.
Right.
So I did want to drive home that point, but mainly I wanted to inspire people about what a beautiful planet we live on and why it's important to take care of it.
I like it. How about for you? Did you have a personal in on that in thematically?
Well, over the course of the years that we would put this together, yeah, we back and forth ideas and but you know, it's Tony's vision primarily. It's just my job to see that it gets put up on the screen. Yeah. So we've worked together on what, 7 films now, I guess, in space. So
what were the 7? You don't have to go into them big, you know, rattle them off.
Well, the first one was our sort of proof of concept to get NASA's attention that IMAX was a good medium for spreading the word about what NASA does, and that was Hail Columbia. Which was about the maiden voyage of the space shuttle. And then we actually got cameras into space for the next film, which was The Dream is Alive. Mm-hmm. And then following that, we did Destiny in Space, we did Blue Planet.
Yeah.
And then that was the Earth-looking film. And then we turned around and looked the other way for Destiny in Space. And that was really about the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope, but also looking as to how we could explore planets and the stars beyond. Then we did a really interesting one, which was another proof of concept, but this time NASA's proof of concept. Could Russia and the U.S. work together prior to building the space station?
There were a series
of exploratory flights where they docked in space and worked together.
To the Mir space station, and tried,
could they speak English and Russian and exchange and everything? And they asked us to cover that activity, which we did. And that one was called Mission to Mir. And then we did Hubble 3D. Then we did Space Station 3D, which was about the on-orbit building of the space station, which is an incredible engineering achievement. That we flew 7 flights for. And then after that, we did Hubble 3D, which we went back and covered the final repair of the Hubble, and which, of course, in the meantime, had revolutionized the way we think about the cosmos.
Yeah.
And now a beautiful planet.
Do you have a particular? You can't say, and you're not allowed to say the whole thing. But a particular favorite image or sequence in the film that, when you got those images back, you said, "Wow, this is really something."
Well, it's like, what's your favorite child? Who's your favorite child?
I'm gonna make you pick your favorite child.
I really the Aurora images, I think, kind of evoke a lot of thought and mystery because they're so ethereal looking. I like those, and I like the city's nightlights, because you can see where all the population centers are easily at night, and you see what kind of impact we have on the ocean at night, in that you see all the fishing boats out at sea. And I think that's probably, those are the two broad categories that I like the best.
The biggest surprise to me was that by moonlight, you could actually see the colors of the Bahama reefs in the ocean with no lighting other than the moon. That was really a revelation.
Wow. This is your seventh or eighth? Seventh. After doing this so often, how does it affect you personally? You must walk around and look up and look around and feel like we're much, you know, smaller, you know.
Well, this film really, and Hubble and this film both kind of put you in your place for, you know, our place in the cosmos, Hubble in particularly, but when you start with a blue, beautiful planet, you realize that this is a really unique place, and we're not going to go anywhere from here too quickly.
Yeah.
So you got to take care of it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I dream in zero gravity.
Really?
Sometimes. Oh yeah, I've had multiple dreams of flying through places and stuff like that.
So you're actually floating out of your bed while you're sleeping.
Yeah, that's as close as I'm going to get. So.
Mine always involves launch failures.
So. You always wake up right when you get to one.
Up, yeah.
That's awesome. Abort dream.
Abort dream.
Oh, that's great. How did you both become filmmakers? I'm always curious when I have filmmakers.
Don't go. No, she's going to go. She's going to go there. I know she is. Okay. Oh, no.
I met James when he was just about naked on a dive boat.
Theater of the mind and radio.
There we go. I had a Speedo on. All right.
Okay.
And I was working for the co-founder and co-inventor of IMAX, Graham Ferguson. And we were doing the first ever underwater film that IMAX had done with a housing, a camera in the housing. And we were on a dive boat, and there was this handsome young lad there with nearly no clothes on. And that's where we met James. But I started as a film editor and started working with Graham prior to the invention of IMAX. And then he asked if I would edit the first all IMAX film, and I did. And 45 years later.
Wow. Yeah. Here we are.
Yeah.
Talk about the sort of how IMAX has grown and how it's, you know, it's no longer this, like you said, you had sort of had to prove that it would work, but now it's pretty, you know, well accepted. It's at multiplexes, major, even, you know, fiction films are being done in it too. Explain how that sort of took hold and where it's going. One of you guys.
I think that's a better Tony question than me.
Well, yeah, you were there at the inception.
Yeah.
I think initially, of course, it was a film medium that very quickly had an application for theme parks and, you know, had a kind of thrill component to it because you're right in the picture, a big, beautiful, clear, crystal clear picture. And it became a medium that took people where they couldn't normally go, like into space and to the bottom of the sea. And then that evolved into natural history films and it was mainly museums, planetariums, and theme parks to start. But the owners, the original inventors, always wanted and fantasized about expanding into Hollywood films and dramas. But that's a very difficult thing to do. And they tried and tried and they tried to raise the money in order to try and do that in Canada. It's a Canadian invention. And they just couldn't do that. And so eventually they sold the company to an investment bankers who took the company public. And now there are over 1,000 theaters. And, of course, we started, I guess it was in the early 90s, with one Hollywood studio making repurposing of a film for IMAX display. And now we're working with every studio that exists, and I think the releases number some 46 a year of Hollywood films. Wow. So it's expanded exponentially. Yeah. And then most of the growth recently has been in China and Asia.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. And, sir, how did you get into your craft, you know, before the Speedo?
Well, the Speedo actually was part of it, I think. I, at that point, had just graduated from film school in Southern California and kind of Brooks Institute of Photography at the time, and had minored in underwater photography. So I went to work for a little production company that specialized in underwater, and along came Tony and Graham with this big camera and said, we want to make this movie.
Yeah.
And, I taught Graham how to dive and not kill himself, and then they took me along for comic relief and to keep him alive when he went in the water, and that's how I got into IMAX. And then we just, you know, fortunately I succeeded in keeping Graham alive, so they brought me back on a few other films and then the space program films.
Awesome. Yeah. Who wrote the script for this thing?
I wrote the script mostly, but okay. I had help. I always ask Graham, again, who's my mentor and emeritus. So he helped a lot. John Grunsfeld helped a lot. John is the retiring AA for space science at NASA. And I'd worked with him closely on Hubble. So he was a big contributor. Frank Summers from the Space Telescope Science Institute also helped us with the Milky Way scenes. And lots of people. You know, anybody that had an opinion, we listened to it all.
Well, and the astronauts semi wrote it because what Tony does, she sits down with the astronauts and has a conversation like this about what their experiences were and what the images were, and then puts that together as as the
important
track,
to yeah. say that yes, the voiceover apart from Jennifer, mm-hmm. The voiceover of the astronauts that you hear is their own words, and we say that on the credits.
Cool.
You know, I don't write that for them. I couldn't
right.
possibly write it.
Right.
It's very candid, mm-hmm. experiential stuff, and they do a wonderful job at it.
Right. Speaking of, so now let's go into Jennifer Lawrence. How did you get her on board? You can't get a bigger Hollywood name to talk in your movie.
Just amazing. It was wonderful to work with her. I was just thrilled. All that I knew was that I did want a female voice for the film, and I had actually dragged, kicking and screaming, done Blue Planet myself by accident, it just seems the subject matter seems to suit a female voice, and my boss, who is CEO of IMAX Entertainment in Hollywood, who is very, very plugged into the Hollywood scene, has gotten us wonderful narrators for the last four films. Tom Cruise did Space Station 3D, and then we had Kate Winslet and Johnny Depp for an underwater film called Deep Sea. We had Jim Carrey for another underwater film called Under the Sea, and then Leonardo DiCaprio for Hubble, and now Jennifer Lawrence. So I've been really spoiled.
A long tradition.
Really
long
spoiled.
Tradition.
And I thought Jennifer did a marvelous job on this.
They all did. Do you get to communicate with all of these celebs along the way? How much communication is there with
them?
Or is it mostly they're just reading a script somewhere far away?
No. I have to direct them. I have to go to where they are and record them. And then usually we go back and do a pickup session of, you know, a couple of things we wish we, you know, wanted to do over. So there's, you know, direct interaction, absolutely. And they're all absolutely wonderful to work with. They're not huge stars for nothing. They're very, very focused and hardworking, wonderful people. I really, really enjoyed working with all of them, and Jennifer did a fabulous job.
What's something about her that, you know, behind the scenes that people might not know about her?
She has
just from working with her in person.
She has a wonderful sense of humor, spontaneous sense of humor. she's, you know, very, very down to earth. I mean, when I think
pun intended.
Yeah, she's amazingly composed, though, for someone who's 25. I mean, just amazing. No, I really enjoyed her sense of humor.
How do you think having her, you know, and being able to plaster her on the poster at the Air and Space, you know, how do you think that brings in, you know, all ages? Because, you know, you get the clout and the acclaim of her, you know, American Hustle and Silver Linings and all that, but then also you have the Katniss bring in the younger crowd, you know. Do you think that sort of brings in multiple generations?
I don't know myself if there is data that says a famous narrator fills seats. I couldn't tell you that. I would like to think that certainly, especially in this film, that Jennifer's appeal to a younger demographic would reach younger kids. And she's her own passion for the subject. I mean, she was really genuinely, and I showed her the film before she agreed to sign up.
Sure.
And so we had a screening in New York, and she loved the film, and I could tell right then and there that she was passionate about the subject matter. So that's really a good fit.
The only data point I have is like on my Twitter, because, you know, I'll tweet something about the film, and if one of her fan groups retweets it, my Twitter blows up because it's included on that stuff.
Right.
You know, so it definitely has an effect on the viewing public that way.
That's awesome. Yeah, when you put that at JLaw, whatever
Twitter is, then it blows up.
Yeah.
I've forgotten about social media didn't exist at the time when we did the early films.
Right.
So
no.
there wasn't that kind of wildfire, you know, spread of information.
Yeah.
It's a whole new world.
I don't even know how to tweet.
Oh, come on. We got to show. We'll show
well,
you.
Well, I've got a Facebook page, but I'm kind of scared of it.
Yeah. I only mess with Facebook and Twitter. I don't have time for all the rest. Awesome. Is there anything else? I mean, what's the final pitch if someone's listening to this and they're, you know, they're driving in their car, they're semi-interested, but they're on the fence because they just went to Air and Space. Why should they go back and see this?
Well, I think that it's a unique trip to space. exactly. You feel it's a 3D film, so you feel that you're right in up there in the space station, looking out the window alongside the crew. Yeah. Absolutely, you're there, and that's what the astronauts all say. It is the next best thing to being there. And I also think it's quite an emotional experience. I feel that way. I don't know about you.
No, James, I think it's probably one of the most emotional films I think we've made, space films we've made, because you really get this whole feeling that, yeah, we've got a really special place in this galaxy. And
it does explore our place in the cosmos, in that the film opens with a fabulous 3D flight that's real through the Milky Way. And then we find our little sun over on one outside arm of it.
Yeah.
And then we find the planet. And on the way back, on the way at the end, we go the opposite way. And we leave Earth in one beautiful shot and fly back into the Milky Way and out to a Goldilocks zone where the Kepler satellite has found planets orbiting another star.
What is a Goldilocks zone?
Not too hot, not too cold.
Just right
for water to exist.
That's why
it's called that. And there's a wonderful satellite called Kepler that has been finding exoplanets for several years.
Found
4,000 of them already. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them you can rule out as other Earths because they're gas giants like Jupiter. Right. They're either too big, too small, or too close to the star, or too far away. So when you find one that is just the right distance, that means it could be terrestrial and it could have water.
Or porridge.
Or porridge or life.
Yeah.
The one that we examined at the end of the film. It is 500 light years from Earth. So I tried to figure out this morning really in miles. And if you can do 500
times... It's a lot of zeros.
5.88 trillion miles and come up with a figure in miles, better man. Yeah.
No, that's why I'm in radio. I can't do that.
I ran out of toes at 5.
Yeah, exactly.
So it'll be a while before our humans can go there.
Well, who knows? Maybe one day someone on one of those porridge planets in the Goldilocks zone, maybe they'll have folks like you sending film crew out, and maybe you guys, your cameras will cross
the dark.
Well, I wish I could. I hope I can be here when the message inbound from one of those reaches us.
Right, absolutely.
You never know.
That'll be a game changer.
You never know.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming in, guys. All right, what's the runtime on it?
It's 46 minutes and 12 seconds.
3D IMAX at the National Air and Space Museum starting April 29th. And how long does it run? Is it all summer or for a year? I know those things have pretty extended runs sometimes.
I think it'll have a fairly extended run.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you miss it on April 29th,
Weekend, it won't go away for a few days anyway.
It'll be there for a while. And do we know what it costs to get in, the admission? I'm sure it's on their website.
Yeah. I'm not sure at the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
But it's priceless.
They don't charge us.
They don't charge to get in the museum, but I don't know what they charge for the
movie.
Well, we'll find it on the website and throw it up there for you so you guys can find out. But definitely check it out. Remind the title again? It's
A Beautiful Planet.
A Beautiful Planet. Thanks so much for your time. This was fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.